is George, and I am an alcoholic. This is, I'm so grateful to be here. This is wonderful. I really want to thank the event committee for the work that they did to put on the Sobriety in the Sierras conference. And thank you to Doug as well for thinking of me and asking me. It's wonderful to be somewhere else out of the Bay Area and at a meeting of AA. You know, I can only speak for this alcoholic. And I was telling my story at the table I was sitting to, not my story, but, you know, I got up this morning. I had planned on leaving early. I didn't want to make Doug feel nervous, like, is he going to show? Is he not going to show? And then, of course, you know, since I took the day off of work today, the alarm clock went off at, 7:30 or something like that. And I didn't get up till like 10. So I'm like, I've got a 3.5-hour drive. I can do that, no problem. As I'm leaving out the door, my wife says, aren't you going to eat anything? And I'm like, don't stop me now. I'm late. I got to get going. No, I can't eat right now. So I arrive here. It's pretty hungry. I wolfed down 2 hot dogs. They were wonderful, but I don't know if that was the best idea since I'm going to spend the duration up here or a good part of the evening up at this podium, so I'm hoping for the best. What I'm really bummed about was that somebody was reading the itinerary for tonight and they said, there's an ice cream social and, you know, they're going to be serving ice cream. And I thought, great, I love ice cream. And they said, it's, you know, 15 minutes before you speak. I said, oh, I better not. I might have to use the bathroom in between. I don't want to embarrass myself. So, I have so much to share with you this evening in such little time. That's just a joke. I mean, to be honest with you, I have never spoke at the podium for an hour. I've shared many times my story. Tonight will be my unabridged story. Kind of, you get the whole story and nothing but the story. Before I share anywhere, you know, I always have anxiety a little bit. I mean, I know that I'm amongst my people, and I do feel comfortable, and I love looking out at your faces, the ones that are awake and looking at me. But you know, I have anxiety, so I say a little prayer. I ask God to open my heart and just pull out any truth that's there so that I can be of service to the fellowship. You know, I hope that something that I may say people can relate to or identify with. And that's my prayer, and it kind of centers me and grounds me and comforts me a little bit. So I'll just go ahead and get started and let you know what it was like. I am not a native Californian, nor have I met many native Californians here. I have lived in California for longer than I did my home state of Illinois. I'm a Chicagoan. But I don't typically meet a lot of native Californians. And so, you know, I think that back home, I want to say a bunch of good things about my parents because they both have passed, but are beautiful people that did a great job as best as they could bringing me up. I was not an easy task. I often didn't listen and usually would just do the opposite of whatever my instruction was. Now, I told Teresa earlier, I follow instructions to the best of my ability, but, you know, when I was young, I didn't. My parents were both immigrants from Greece. So, you know, it was, and I was talking to Maybow about, you know, both of our parents had immigrated, hers from China, mine from Greece, and how it's kind of like the dream to assimilate, right? To come to this country and to become an American and to pick up on what Americans do. You know, she had shared a little bit about her parents. And so that's exactly what my dad did. I don't know if you're familiar with Greeks. Greeks are typically, at least in my neck of the woods in the Midwest, involved in the restaurant business. And so my family was too. My father's uncle had come here before him, years before, and established themselves with restaurants. And my dad came, and then he got his start in the restaurant business. However, my dad owned a bar. It was a steam table and bar, so they did serve food there. And the reason I tell you this is because, you know, alcohol was always around me. It wasn't a problem at the beginning, but it was always around me. my dad being a bar owner, in our house, I remember as a kid, we had bottles stashed everywhere. My dad would bring home bottles. Now, my dad didn't, I'm not going to say he didn't drink. He really didn't drink. But like if he was at a wedding or something like that, he probably felt awkward and would have a drink to fit in with everybody, back to the assimilation story. But you know, he would give them out for birthdays and wedding anniversaries and Christmas and all that. So, you know, in every nook and cranny of our house growing up, we had bottles of liquor and bottles of wine. And as a kid, I didn't do anything about it, but I would just look at them. And I was like, wow, there's a lot of liquor in here. And, you know, and they would be in the trunk of his car, too, in case somebody said, oh, it's my birthday today. And he'd whip out a bottle from the trunk, right? And so it wasn't until a little later on, probably as I got older, maybe in sixth grade or whatever, is when I really took interest in that. My buddies and I at that time were, you know, at the beginning, I was a weekend warrior, right? So I'd go to events that the school would have, I'd drink before that, drink after that, and, you know, and then the week would come around and I wouldn't have another drink. But we weren't certainly old enough to buy alcohol in sixth grade, although the liquor laws were 19 at the time there, but I was still far away from that. So I thought, my dad will never miss one bottle if I took one bottle. And I was just taking and I didn't know the difference between any of the liquor that he had there. So, I mean, I was just pulling at random, whatever it was. I remember my friends would say, you know, what do you got in your backpack or whatever. I didn't have a clue. It's, you know, whatever I felt like I could snatch and maybe get away with it, and they wouldn't notice it. And so, you know, my drinking kind of started there. I will say that when I was younger and before I had even one drink, I always, and I've heard this shared so many times in the rooms of AA, I always had a feeling of being a little bit uncomfortable in my own skin. And by that, what I mean was, I don't mean I was ostracized and outcast, didn't have any friends. That was not the case. But it was of the utmost importance. Like, it preoccupied my mind all the time that I just wanted to fit in, and that maybe I was a fake, and that somebody might pick up on that, right? And so I wanted to dress the way that everybody dressed back then, bell bottoms, and you know, the guys wore platform shoes too, and you know, and long, and my hair still is long now, but it was longer then, you know, and I just wanted to fit in exactly like everybody else. And you know, that's what I found with alcohol, was that feeling of kind of those insecurities just floated away. Like, I just didn't pay any attention to that. Where normally I'd be preoccupied with those things, but all of a sudden, a couple drinks, and I felt comfortable, and I felt talkative, and I felt confident, and it worked for me, you know? And so I used that for the rest of my drinking career. Although, you know, those innocent times did not stay that way. We talk about fun and fun with problems, and in the end, just problems. And you know, that eventually I'll get to that in my story. But you know, that's what I found too. In high school, my drinking probably picked up more. That was the first time I probably went to a kegger party, right, for some event. You know, on a Friday or Saturday, you know, and it's just like one of those things where everybody's doing it. You know, it was one of those things. I'm not going to say that I didn't like the taste of alcohol and I was doing it just because everybody was. I really didn't have a problem with the taste of it, which was bad for me, I guess, in hindsight, in retrospect. But, you know, it was just one of those things that you did. It was kind of growing up in the Midwest. I will say about the Midwest, too, and I was talking from somebody else in my table from, he had lived some time in Alaska. When you live in a cold weather state in the winter, there is not much to do but drink. I mean, I'm sure that there's a lot to do, but in my mind, that was like, you know, I looked around and that's what everybody was doing. And so again, I just picked up on those social cues and for this alcoholic, I just ran with it too long, too far. But I think that really, if I look back about it, about my drinking career, it probably wasn't until I went away to college. I was fortunate enough, being the first generation born here, my parents wanted me to get an education and it's a better life. My dad did not want me to be working at his bar. And he wanted me to get an education. And so I didn't necessarily want that. I was kind of lazy, maybe would be the right word. Didn't want to apply myself. I remember as a kid, you'd get your report card. Now I'm talking like third, fourth, fifth grade. You get your report cards, and they would, and the teachers would write something on there, and they'd say, you know, generally George is a good student if he would only apply himself a little bit more. If he only cared a little bit more about academics, he would be a really good student. I don't know what it was, but my the interest wasn't there. But my parents wanted me to go to college. I had other plans, but I decided to make them happy and go away to college. Well, you know, for an alcoholic in the making, sending somebody off an 18-year-old as an 18-year-old to college, I mean, I was liberated. I was no longer under the house rules. I didn't have a curfew, not that I listened to a curfew before. My mom would tell you that she would give me all types of curfews, and I would always break them. But now here I find myself in an environment where I could do whatever I want, and there's no repercussion, or so I thought. There's no judgment, and I just took off running at that point. I didn't fare well. I did graduate college. I'm very proud to say that. I don't know how I did that. I mean, by the skin of my teeth, I guess you would say. I remember my first year as a freshman in college, attended very few classes. I remember I went to the first class of the new year, looked at the syllabus, and identified when the midterm and finals were. So I thought, okay, I can attend this one to collect the syllabus and the two tests, and I'm good. Right? Three, attend class three times, and I should be good. I should be able to pass. That didn't work out so well for me. And after my freshman year, I was just failing miserably. And they put me on academic probation. And I said they said that the second semester you have to lift your grade point average to a 2.0 or you will be academically dismissed. And I was academically dismissed. I went home for the summer. I went home for good, but it was the summer. I went home and I got a letter, and the letter said, if you come repeat a whole bunch of classes, pay more money, and bring your grade point average up to 2.0, we'll readmit you. And I knew that I loved college for the drinking, for the lifestyle that it was. I mean, really, you know, it's a sad story to say, but that was my motivation to go back to college. Not because I wanted to make something of myself or that I had some passion or interest about a subject, but it was just great being able to do what I was doing, which was drinking all the time. And so that motivated me to go back, and I was readmitted. I did, in college, I moved out of the dorms and I moved into this house. It was a 10-bedroom house. 10 guys lived in there. And actually, I said so much before me getting up here that I feel like I'm repeating myself. But, you know, we had this house, and we paid our rent by throwing kegger parties. Every other weekend, we'd have a kegger party. It was $3 for guys, blue solo cup, $2 for girls, red solo cup, and you could drink all night. We would go through like 16 half barrels in a night. I mean, we had CO2 taps. We were just, you know, flooding the place with alcohol, with mainly beer then. I mean, people had their spirits as well, but it was mainly beer. And, you know, where I felt most comfortable was, you know, it's weird because, like I said at the beginning, I was a person that maybe generally didn't feel comfortable, or at least wanted to make sure that I was exactly like everybody else. But, I mean, I felt so comfortable behind the bar that we had built in that house. Serving people, and obviously I didn't have to wait in any beer line because I was right at the tap. And so I had control of the stereo, I had the beer right there, I was like king, and I had my audience in front of me, everybody coming up needing beer from me. And, you know, the big book talks about king alcohol, and that's exactly what it became to me. It preoccupied all of my thoughts. When I wasn't drinking, I was putting into motion plans to start drinking. Or if I was drinking, plans to how am I going to get home? That's part of my story too, and I'll get to that in a minute. But my priorities in life. And as you grow older, you know, when you're young, I guess my priority was school. You know, but if you get married, have a family, stuff like that, then you get some priorities that go with that. My priorities were never in the right order. Alcohol was always at the forefront of my mind. And I'll move forward a little bit. I will tell you that I graduated college. And I decided, you know, I was one of those people that thought, I'm never going to stay in the same town that I was born in. Like, I heard about people that, and I don't mean any offense to any of you, if you've lived in the, I think that's wonderful. But for me, I wanted to explore the world. I wanted to live in other places. I had a girlfriend at the time. I had a camper van that I purchased. That camper van was wonderful because it was like a house on wheels, and I can go anywhere and drink as much as I want and then just crash in the van. In fact, you know, and I might as well start a little bit talking about my drinking and driving. I was always the driver. When I went away to college, not many people, not like nowadays, not many people had cars. I had a car there. And so I was the, you know, so then if somebody got the address to a party, I was the one that drove us to the party and drove us back. I was the driver all the time, and I was always the drunk driver all the time. It just became my role. I don't know that I raised my hand and said, I want this role, but somehow, you know, like you get a service commitment, right, Doug? It becomes your role. Whether you want it or not, it became my role, and I became very comfortable, cocky. Not just comfortable, but cocky with my driving. So I'll go back a little bit. So I wanted to travel. You know, I chose California because I had heard from somebody that pot grows in the cracks of the sidewalks of California. And I was like, are you kidding me? That's the place for me. I could just bend over and pick it up? Unreal. This is well before the legalization of marijuana or any drug, you know, at the time. And I was just like, man, that's where I'm going. So I took off to California. Didn't necessarily find that to be the case, but it was readily accessible. I kept in communication with a lot of my college buddies. And I never recognized one of the beauties about sobriety is that I could catch myself nowadays at the very beginning of something rather than travel down a path that might not be the best road, you know, but back then I couldn't. So I had these conversations with my roommates just trying to stay in touch. Hey, how's it going, man? Where are you at nowadays? Where are you living? Oh, I moved to Michigan, or I moved to Wisconsin, or whatever. Why'd you move there? They offered me, for my career. They offered me a great job, so I took it, you know. I took whatever job I could get with a college degree. I didn't follow what my degree was in, you know, but it looked like they had a plan, and they were following a plan. And my plan was always to not have any plan. I've said that. I don't like order. Chaos was the way that I live my life. I don't like to plan. My wife is a planner, and it pisses the shit out of me. She plans, sorry, I don't know if I'm supposed to swear or not, but she plans everything, and I'm just not built that way. So, you know, I would call them from time to time, and they would tell me, oh, I met this girl, and, you know, and then all of a sudden, now I'm engaged, and now I'm, you know, getting married, and for me, I was doing the exact same thing that I always did in college. I was drinking exactly the same. I wasn't prioritizing life as you get older and progress, you know, with thinking about career and families and stuff like that. They had all moved, although, and this helps me with alcoholism. When I struggled at the beginning, am I alcoholic? Am I not alcoholic? You know, I could look at people like some of my college roommates, I'm not going to say all of them, but some of them, you know, were able to walk away from that lifestyle and begin a mature adult lifestyle where they do all the things that adults do, like work and accomplish things and just stand with respect for yourself, right? I had no respect for myself at all. I was just a falling down alcoholic. And I didn't see that at the time. I kind of thought, like, poor them. Like, they're saddled with a job, and they got. It sounds like, oh man, now they're having kids. They're never going to be able to go out to a party. Kids will keep you at home. You know, is what I thought. This is the way my mind worked. I didn't mature. I could say that the program of AA at 43 years old, when I entered the program, was the first growth or maturity that I had since I was 16 years of age. I had really not matured. I was defiant. I didn't want, if you told me to do something, I wanted to do the exact opposite. No respect for the law at all. Just no respect for your own safety. I was on the road every day, drunk. That's who I was. The program has really taught me so much about maturity and responsibility and growing up. You know, it's just amazing that it took me to find AA to finally grow up in my 40s. But going back to that time, I was still drinking and driving. And I said, I was cocky about it. So I often said, my vehicle, I had a Jeep Wrangler, and I'm like, it's got like autopilot. Like, I don't really have to, and this was before phones, there was no navigation or anything like that. You just knew where you were going or you didn't know where you were going. You either know it or you're lost. Or you stop at a gas station and buy a map or something like that. But I would say, oh, my vehicle knows its way home. I don't even really have to put my hands on the steering wheel. And I reinforced that stupid thought time and time again by driving drunk. I was not the type of drinker that isolated. I was the type of drinker that liked to be in the thick of things. The bigger the crowd at a bar, shoulder to shoulder, with no room. I mean, I know it sucks because you can't get alcohol, but I mean, I just love something about being in the thick of the crowd. So I was a bar drinker, and that's where I was at home, and that's where I went out and did my drinking. And every night, that's where I drove home, time and time again. My wife, I'd come home. So let me tell you this. Let me tell you a little bit about that relationship. So my wife and I thought were exactly the same. We were like salt and pepper shakers. They go hand in hand. You find them always both on the table, not one without the other. We drank and drugged, for full disclosure, the same. But my drinking got overhand, out of hand. This alcoholic, for me, more is always what I wanted. Again, with that preoccupation, I started going to parties and then like looking at the amount of liquor that they had and thinking, this probably is not going to be enough. So I'm going to take some of this liquor and I'm going to shove it into the very back of the crisper drawer in the refrigerator, or I'm going to find a basement refrigerator, or I'm going to put this bottle behind this bookshelf or whatever. Now the wheels are turning and I'm planning about all this. Because I don't think that there's enough alcohol there for me. And I think that, and the reason being is if I would go home at a reasonable hour, like, I don't know what would be reasonable, midnight or 2 maybe would be reasonable, but no, I was the thing that wouldn't leave. So I'm there till 5 or 6, and I'm probably crashing on your sofa too. So, I'm hiding booze all over the house and all that. Well, my wife got sick and tired of this behavior. She would say to me, it's 2 a.m., I'm tired. Can we go now? And that was my cue to go hide. Like I would go out, run outside, go in the basement, just start eluding her. If I caught her in the corner over there, I'd be out of that room and into another room because I'm just now avoiding her. She wants to go and I don't want to go. So it got to the point where she says, well, I still want to party, but I can't be there with you till 5 or 6 in the morning. So I'm going to drive my vehicle and you drive your vehicle and then I can go home when I want. And this worked out perfect, so I thought, for me. Because at 2 in the morning, when she would leave, now there was nobody to answer to. Now it's like when I really escalated the drinking. Like between those hours of when she left and early morning, I just consumed even more. I loved the fact that she left. I would come home and I would try to not wake her up and slide into bed. It's quiet. But I reeked of alcohol and my wife's a light sleeper. So I'd wake her up and oftentimes I would be berated with, I can't believe that you drove home like that. She's just like, you are a wreck. And I would say, why? I'm not hurting anybody. I'm fine. My pat answer was always, I'm not hurting anybody. If I'm on my fifth martini watching the game on my living room sofa, I'm not hurting anybody, right? But what about, you know, the not paying attention to my wife, the, you know, all the not physically being there, but not emotionally being there, you know, just being a distant husband, being off in my alcoholic delusional world, I guess is what I'll call it. And so it got to the point where she stopped going to those parties. She said to me, you know, I'm standing there next to you and you're not even speaking English. She's like, I don't know what language it is, but it's not English. And your drunken buddies seem to understand that language because they're nodding their heads and all that. But I'm done with this, she said. I'm done. I'm not going to go to these parties with you anymore. Even better, I thought. Now I don't have to wait until she leaves. Now I could just drink the way that I want to the whole time. And I did that for years and years. I remember my first DUI. I tore my ligament in my ankle, I believe it was, and so I had a clutch. I couldn't drive that. My boss lent me his car. Now, this is the worst, when you get a DUI in your boss's car. But that was my case. I said, hey, listen up. I can't make it to work because I can't drive because I have a manual. And he says, go ahead, take my vehicle. I got an extra spare. You could have it. I go out drinking one night, and I'm coming home. I don't know. I hit a curb, blew out the tire, tried to limp the vehicle home. The rubber was getting bound up in the wheel well, and I was just slowly limping home. Came up to a red light, blacked out or passed out or fell asleep at that red light. And the next thing I know, I hear I'll use sound effects. I hear a rap on the glass, and I come to you, and it's the cops, or a cop. And he says, I need you to get out of the vehicle. So I open up my door to get out of the vehicle while the car is still in gear. And as soon as I go to step out of the car is going forward through the intersection. Really pissed this cop off really bad. You know, needless to say, I got a DUI that night. I don't think that I had ever been, I'd been in some trouble before, but now trouble was escalating. It was starting to creep up on the trouble meter here, you know, because now you have that phone call and your wife's involved and I'm in the drunk tank and all that. But what I realized was not once did I ever think of getting sober after that first experience, after that first DUI. I don't know why that is. I mean, maybe I might attribute it to the pain wasn't great enough. You know how we say we have to hit our bottom before we can get sober? And for some people, their bottom is the tolerance they have, their threshold for tolerance. You know, some people's threshold for pain is higher. Like they'll say, if you don't quit drinking, your spouse might say, I'm going to divorce you. And that would make that individual stop drinking. Not me, but it would make an individual stop drinking. That wasn't enough. You know, other people have to experience real pain in their lives to maybe contemplate getting sober. So that first DUI was nothing. You know, I remember I was sentenced to go to DUI school or whatever you want to call it, drinker driver school, and I didn't stop drinking. I would not drink before going to class and then drink directly afterwards. It was kind of a rather long, my blood alcohol content was super high, and so I had to do like 18 months of this class. And so anyways, I remember after I call it graduate, we went out to the bar afterwards. Every single person that was in attendance of that went out to the bar. I learned nothing from that. And that's a sad statement, because what I'll tell you is that 18 months later, I got my second DUI. I had just gotten a new job. I was working at one of the Valley's Bay Area sweetheart companies, a big, big company. And I thought in my head, this is my gravy ticket. This is it. I won't have to ever get another job. I'll ride this out till retirement. Their compensation was great, and I got it made. you know? And so I'd been at this company for 3 months. They were going out for Cinco de Mayo. I thought, what better way to get to know people than to go out to an event with them? And so I said, sure, I'll go with my group to this tequila bar. But I did know that I didn't want to get too, too bad. So I was reserved, or so I thought. And I left kind of early. It wasn't 2 a.m. So that night at midnight, I left. I was headed home, as I usually was. The next thing I know, I hit something. And I didn't know what I hit, but I was thinking, I live kind of like where suburbia meets country. So I thought maybe it was a deer, but it was pretty late, and deer aren't out usually at that time of night. So I didn't pull over immediately. I was on an expressway, but I did pull over at the next off-ramp. I got out of my vehicle, started looking around, and I saw the windshield was cracked, and I saw the side of your view mirror was off, and I saw the hood rumpled. And I put my head into my hands as I sat on the curb, and I can tell you that was the first time that I lost hope, because I was afraid of what had happened. A few minutes later, police found me, I suppose is what you would call it. The officer asked me if I knew what I hit. I said, no. He said, you hit a person and you killed him. And he says, now you're going to go to prison for a long time. And I had no response for that. That was it. My head just blew at that moment. And so kind of my story of AA begins there. I was able to bail out. I bailed out. I got an attorney, and my attorney said, here's some things you need to do in order to look good in front of the judge and a jury when you go to trial. You need to go to AA. You need to go to therapy. You need to check yourself into a treatment facility. You need to change everything about your life, he said. I don't know what's going to happen to you, but he's like, that's the best thing that could, no matter what happens to you, that's the best thing that could happen to you. And so that's where my journey of AA begins. I remember I listened to his advice. This is the first time I listened to any adult, even though I'm an adult at 43 years old. I considered everybody like older than me in my head. So I'm like, I think I'm going to listen to this guy. So I started going to meetings, you know, and I didn't know what I'd find at these meetings. I sat in the back. It's the typical story. I sat in the back. I got there, you know, a second before the meeting started, left immediately after the meeting was over. But it was weird because I know that these people were talking to me and they were embracing me and they wanted to hear why I was there. And eventually I shared my story and they buoyed me when I was hopeless. They gave me a little hope. And so it was 3 years until I went to trial. It took 3 years for me to go to trial from that accident. So I laid the foundation of my sobriety in those 3 years prior to, yes, I was convicted and sent to prison. But I laid the foundation of sobriety through Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to meetings daily, oftentimes multiple meetings. I got a sponsor. I got a sponsor, but not really the way that I'd recommend. I would say, don't do this. I listened to people, and I thought, well, can I play golf with this guy? Can I shoot the shit with this guy? Is this guy, you know, is he like me? I mean, you know, people sometimes choose their sponsor because they've been through a similar experience or whatever, and that's what I did. I think this guy probably at meeting level shared that he was in some type of accident, and so, but it's important that you get a sponsor right away. And I did that. The treatment facility that I was at, you had to get a sponsor within the first 3 weeks. So I started doing things that were suggested or in treatment. Really, I was told to do these things. So had a sponsor, was going to multiple meetings, was going to a variety of meetings. They said, you need to go to a men's meeting where people really open up and get honest so that there's no ladies there for you to, your bravado or ego can have any part of that. You know, you need to be a part of a men's meeting. I did all that. And I got into service. And so what I want to emphasize this evening is that service is like the cornerstone, the linchpin, the key to my sobriety. And oftentimes, sir, it's funny because I said all these things earlier today. Oftentimes, did I always want to be of service? No, I was trying to be directly behind somebody else's head so that you wouldn't see me. Like I wanted to be invisible a lot of times early on in my sobriety. Did not want to be of service. But a lot of times my sponsor just said, over here, pointed to me, George is here for a commitment. So I did a commitment. I started to follow through. I started to see maturity in myself. This was amazing. This is something that I was experiencing and witnessing for myself. Something that finally, in sobriety, I was able to see. Because if I was out there still, I could never see growth in myself. Nor did I probably have any growth. But now I'm starting to see things. I'm starting to see that AA, the program of AA, works. The other thing that I can share with you is I'd watch people go up to the podium and share, and all of a sudden I had this, I don't know if envy would be the, because I know it's a seven deadly sin, but you know, like I say, man, that man carries himself well. He speaks eloquently. He delivers a powerful message. I want to be like him. What, you know, look at him. He's all dressed up too, show off. All these things started, the program, there was that attraction. The program started to have an attraction to me. Now, suddenly, I want to be like all of you. Whereas before, I wanted to spend as minimal time as possible with you. The program is working on me, and I'm working the program. I'm doing all those things. Another thing that I advise not to do is delay on your steps. I did that. In the 3 years prior to me being incarcerated, prior to my trial, I went up to step 3, and that was it. I ended at step 3, too scared to go forward. I could blame it on a whole bunch of stuff, there's truth to it. I was emotionally wrecked and not present for those 3 years at all. All that I could think of was that I'm going to spend the rest of my life in prison, and my life is over. So I don't know, but you know, the truth is I didn't act and do those steps. I did do the steps, however, when I, I'll tell you that I had my day in trial 3 years later, in front of a jury of my peers who convicted me, of four felony counts, of manslaughter being the harshest one, drunken driving with great bodily injury, hit and run. So I had those four felonies, and they sentenced me to 9 years in prison. I was told that that was a lenient sentence. I didn't know how I was going to do 9 years in prison. I was sober, but I had never been incarcerated other than those two nights in the drunk tank. You could have put me on the moon, and I would have been more familiar with that than I was in prison. I had to learn. There's a lot of politicking that goes on, and probably there's people in the rooms that know about this, maybe. So I leaned on the program once again. I came in there, I was sober. I heard about a dorm, this is while I was still in county, where it was a recovery dorm. I said, I want to go to that recovery dorm. I was in that recovery dorm. In the recovery dorm, you have to work the steps. You have to select another person that's incarcerated. They don't like the word inmate. So somebody that was incarcerated and work the steps with them. And I worked to say, you had to remember the 12 steps. I remember I had to recite them without looking, verbatim. I started to work the program. I went away, I was endorsed. I went away to somewhere probably right around here. I went to San Quentin first, spent some time in San Quentin. Then I went to Sierra Conservation Center, which is up in these hills. And it's where people go to learn to be firemen so that you could, be a firefighter in Orange. And again, the program was there for me. This is what I have to say about the program of AA. It is, and this is why I'm here tonight and why I'm of service is because it was there for me. Wherever my ass got dragged, it was there for me. And I want it to be there for somebody that needs it going forward. I don't know who that someone might be, but I want it to be there. So when I'm in, let's say, Sierra Conservation Center, people are driving up to, or no, I was in a fire camp, an Angels camp, are driving, H&I members are coming up, and they're bringing a meeting just to me. There was nobody else that was a taker other than myself. And they did that for years. And I got an AA meeting with three people, the two people that drove up and myself. When I returned back, I'll tell you this about the fellowship and why to love the fellowship. Man, they are supportive. I mean, I was loved on and embraced when I returned to my community, my home community. The majority of the people, gratefully, were still there and sober. I was able to plug right back in and pick up where I left off. I was able to get a new sponsor, do the steps again. Doug and I worked together. I'm going to push this podium right off the stage. I feel like not on purpose. I know you're recording. By accident, it would be. the program was there for me, and then I got into more and more service. So I have to talk a little bit about this committee that I spent a full decade on. It's called Bridging the Gap, and it's a subcommittee of general service. There's three. There's H&I. Well, H&I is its own entity in Northern California. Corrections desk would be general under general service if we were typical in other states. But there's PI, public information, CPC, cooperation with the professional community, and Bridging the Gap, BTG. And I started doing Bridging the Gap, and I was just a committee member, and I was the phone coordinator. And so that's where presenters don't bring an AA meeting, but they go into a treatment facility and say, hey, if you want somebody to accompany you, if you feel awkward about going to a meeting of AA after you get out of treatment, if this is your first go-around in sobriety, and you're not sure that you want to go to a meeting after you get out, we have people that will take you there. They're called temporary contacts. And so I would match people up, a temporary contact volunteer with the requester. And I did that for, they're all 2-year commitments, so I did that for 2 years. What a great way, when you get into service, your network of sober people just starts, it's like roots of a tree that just branches. Now I'm talking branches and roots, but it just starts to go in different directions, and you start to meet so many great people and hear so many nuggets of wisdom, and your sobriety just starts to flourish. And so I became the chair of that committee for my district, districts 4 and 40 in Santa Clara County, where I live. And I had a great committee, and I don't know if everybody does this, but I fell in love with my committee. I cried at the end when my chair was done and we were kind of disbanding. Some people stayed, but as a chair of a committee, you roll off so as not to step on the toes of the new chair. At least that's our tradition in the Bay Area. And so I stayed with Bridging the Gap because I loved it so much. I mean, I had these weird opportunities that were so great. Like you'd have these barters with people where you would say, hey, can you maybe speak at a meeting for me or be a temporary volunteer? No, it would be, can you be a temporary volunteer? And the person would say, sure, but I need somebody to speak at the meeting. So I'd be like, okay, I guess I'll speak at your meeting. You'll be my volunteer. And there was all these interactions that would happen. My network just grew, and it was tremendous. You know, the other thing I truly believe is a higher power. And it happened to me today. So I've got 3.5 hours driving here to contemplate worry and anxiety and be anxious about, do I have anything to share of worth with you people and stuff like that. And my phone rings, and I recognize the name because they're in my contacts. And I have not been able to get back to him because I was driving then. We came directly here. But it's a guy from H&I. And he's going to want, you know, something from me. And that's fine. But I mean, you know, I know that he's on the committee, and there's a question or an ask or something. And I think that was that, like I said, I was anxious and nervous, and all of a sudden it's like God is saying everything's going to be okay, and here's some proof of it. You know, you're plugged in, you're good. These people got you. You don't have to worry. You don't have to put up fronts and worry about judgment and stuff like that. You're cradled in their arms. You're fine, you know. And that happens to me all the time. Usually it's somebody reaching out to me. If I'm going through it, not that I, not that I'm thinking about drinking, but like my life isn't going the way that I'd like it to go. Usually my phone rings and it's an AA member, and there's some type of service that I need to be in. And then working with others just takes your head right out of your problems. And that's the solution. It's, you know, service. So after being a chair at the local level, I went up to the area level. We're Area 6, which is California Northern Coastal Area 6, CNCA 06. And I worked on that area committee, and then I became the chair of that committee. And then I had 23 districts underneath that I helped, and I helped them grow. Sometimes there's what we call dark counties, where maybe a committee like Bridging the Gap doesn't exist, and you need to help somebody that's willing to start a committee, build it up, you know. And I found fulfillment in doing that. And then you could showcase committees that are robust, or I should say districts that have large committees, 20 people plus or whatever. You could do events like conferences, like you guys have here. We have something called the Bridging the Gap Forum, you know, and those committees can shine, and they can be an example to other districts of, you know, hey, you could build this up too. Being of service has to be the key to my sobriety. I don't quite know if I'd be, or at least a good sobriety. Maybe I'd still be sober, but yeah, I don't know where I would be today without that. It really is it's amazing. I'm like thinking about it in my head right now. You know, the program has helped in so many ways. My son was 3 years old when I went away to prison, and here's how I left him. And if I don't try to hold back tears, I'd get emotional right now. But one day, I knew I had my attorney called me, and he says the jury's in. They're going to deliver the verdict. You need to be here today at 10 a.m. I walked my son to school that day. We're two blocks away from his elementary school. I smiled at him and said goodbye like nothing was wrong. And then that's the last time I saw him for quite some time. You know, that was really difficult at that time. Just knowing that the way that I looked at it, and I'm never going to be able to look at it from the, I will say this, the person that I killed was a 15-year-old boy, and that was a pedestrian. And so I can't look it through the parents' eyes, but what I do know is that there is a family without their son, and there's another family without their father, and that was me. Maybe, you know, it's a sentence that I needed to serve, but there's two broken families. Now, the destruction that I created is beyond belief. You know, so it takes what it takes to get to the program of AA. You know, I remember early on somebody said, and I repeat this all the time because maybe you've heard of it, but I love it. They said alcoholism is like an elevator going down, and you can get off. You could stop it and get off at any floor that you like, or you can ride it all the way to the bottom. And that bottom is death, incarceration, whatever that bottom is for you. I mean, you could ride it all the way down. When I hear people talk about coming into the program and they say that they came in because of some reason other than one that I had to experience, I wish that that was the reason. You know, I wish that I would have taken heed and come into the rooms at that time earlier. It takes what it takes to get here. And you've got to never forget that. I'm going to say a whole bunch of stuff that I said today. I was sharing, I think, maybe with, not Teresa, somebody I was saying, I heard another thing. They said, that's why the windshield on your vehicle is so large and the rear view mirror is small, because we want to look out towards the future, but we need to look back every now and then into our rearview mirror of our past and remember our past. Because if we forget that, we're going to repeat it. They say that about history all the time, right? So I stay centered in the program of AA as best to my ability. I'm of service. I feel, and I talked, I mentioned this to Doug and Marilyn today. Doug and Marilyn are my keepers this evening. I'm staying at their place. I am uniquely qualified to speak to another alcoholic, possibly a still suffering alcoholic, maybe an alcoholic in early recovery, but I am uniquely qualified. If we as alcoholics need additional help, it is there for us. We can seek psychiatric, medical help and all that. But I mean, one-on-one, one alcoholic to another, language of the heart, as they say, there's no better solution than that. You know, I know a lot of people that say, I won't go to seek medical help or mental help with somebody that isn't in the program because they, learning it out of a book, they can't really identify or relate. And I'm not saying that that people can't. They said that, not me. But you know, it's definitely one alcoholic speaking to another alcoholic. It has righted the ship for the most part in my life. There's a lot of things that are, you know, my marriage is intact. It's not what it once was. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it's better than it once was. Because what it was us partying together till, you know, till blackout. But I could be there today. I'm there for my son. My son, at 3 years old when I went away, doesn't remember me drinking. He doesn't. And so I am so grateful for that. I hear a lot of stories of people and you know, the children becoming the adults in the household because the parents were always under the influence, like myself. But my son was 3 years old when I got sober. Doesn't have that memory. Today I could talk to him. My son's away at college, and people ask me, does your son drink? Yeah, he does at college. I think that it's a pretty normal situation. I have told them there might be a gene that you might have, son. I don't know that to be fact. Be careful. Be safe. He knows my story. He came to visit me finally when I was able to get visitors in prison. So he's seen a little bit of that, but I could be there for him. You know, my son has been in athletics his whole life, and if you told me that I had to get up to go to a soccer game at 6 a.m. when they're young or whatever, you'd have to, or to travel. I mean, we did a lot of traveling. He plays ice hockey at the collegiate level, you know, and to do all this, I was not that person. I couldn't be that person. I could want to be that person, but I couldn't. AA allowed me to become the person that I've wanted to be, that I never knew that I wanted to be, but suddenly realized in sobriety that this is who I want to be, and then the program allowed me to become that person. Miracles happen here. They happen here because you guys are here. I believe that because all of you are here this evening. You're here wherever I go in the rooms of AA. My time is up. I just want to thank you and bless you all.